From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 333, Identity Security, with guest David Jones. Recorded Monday, August 26th, 2013. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thanks, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell of Thanks for Listening to Run As Radio. Today, my guest is David Jones. David is a senior security architect for Cisco's information security team, leading technical security strategy in IT and across the enterprise. In this role, he is responsible for the creation and implementation of security policies. The focus of his current position is to mitigate risk by preventing security breaches. David is responsible for protecting Cisco employees, partner, and customer identities, as well as enabling Cisco products to do the same for Cisco's customers. He is leading multiple identity initiatives across the company. These include integration of identity technologies into Cisco products, securing Cisco's cloud services offering, as well as federating Cisco employee access to the cloud. He has a patent pending for network access product information. Welcome, David.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I've talked to lots of Cisco people over the years. I'm a big fan of the product lines, and there's a huge number of them. But I don't know that I've ever talked to someone who actually does IT work internal to Cisco. That's got to be a tough customer base.
Yeah. It's funny because I talk to other customers or other people in the industry, and they work with normal people.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
People who run business. But when we have to deal with some of our engineers, they know they're smarter than we are.
Or at least they certainly think they are, and there's very little you could do about it.
Exactly. It's possible you may get some credibility after a while, but it's very common that they know that they're better than you are.
That's a tough job, yeah, just in terms of knowing it. Generally speaking, supporting engineers is very challenging. They're very smart guys who tend to want to fix stuff themselves.
Yeah, and the other thing is they all like their own kinds of technology. So I was doing a customer meeting with a large petrochemical company in Japan, and they are very command and control. They get to command and control the user, the platforms that people use for computing.
Right.
Where here at Cisco, yeah, they could be using anything, you know. So when it comes for me protecting access to something, like, or saying for an individual employee, what access do they have to all systems across the company? It's a daunting task because we're talking about different web platforms. We're talking about, say, NetApp filers, all kinds of stuff, Windows hosts, Exchange servers. There's all kinds of things that, you know, it's hard to know what access everyone has across such a heterogeneous environment.
Well, and the engineering mindset is I need it all. I don't have any room for security to impair me for the job I'm doing today. So don't worry about me. I can do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear this a lot. Trust me. I know what I'm doing.
I know what I'm doing. But I mean, the reality is their job is to get their job done. And your job is to maintain some sense of security and integrity around this. They're different jobs.
Yeah. And that's a valid point. No one comes to work to be secure.
They
come to work to be creative, collaborate, get their jobs done. Yeah. So that's one of the things that's an opportunity for me is how do I help people get their jobs done while making sure that something bad doesn't happen.
Yeah, there needs to be locks on the door.
Yeah.
That's always the issue you run into. So what has changed? Identity is such a common, straightforward thing now. I feel like all of our technologies are pretty mature when you talk about stuff like Active Directory and other than TCP security at the IPv6 level, there hasn't been a whole lot of innovation in this space lately.
Yeah, we considered our Active Directory design to be done around 99, 2000. There's only been incremental changes. You know, like when Server 2003 came out, we had the ability for replicating large groups, the performance was enhanced because it would just replicate the deltas. But that wasn't an architectural change. And along those lines, one of the great pushes over identity for the last 10 years is that single sign-on holy grail. How do you get single sign-on across, you know, or even sometimes we call it a zero sign-on. How do you, based on the authentication to your end device, that you never have to get prompted again throughout.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two big changes that happened there. And one of the big changes was it was recognized that not just in theory, because in theory we've been saying for years, you know, well, the problem with single sign-on is if that initial login is compromised, they can get access to everything.
Sure.
Well, that went from being theoretical to actual exploits.
Yeah.
I'll just cite the Mandiant report that came out on the group known as APT1 around RSA last year. But one of the basis of that exploit was once you got on a machine, you go for the single sign-on credentials. And that's one thing that's changed. What's changed in Active Directory is it's now a listing of who important accounts are. So the big target for single sign-on, it's one thing to get an individual user's single sign-on credentials,
sure,
you know, to bypass security to get onto other hosts. But they usually don't have access to very many hosts. If you can compromise the domain administrator or even administrator of just a whole bunch of server systems, mm-hmm, and use their single sign-on credential, which we, you know, the exploit we call pass the hash, you can get to a lot of different systems. So to answer your question, biggest change of the year in those technologies in the identity space is they're actively being exploited and we've been working to mitigate them. So I've said that a few times recently in public. We've had to go back and re-architect our Active Directory infrastructure that was developed for, you know, performance and to help people collaborate and such, so that it now it also doesn't provide an access vector, or what I like to call the remote access VPN of miscreants.
Right. Like just once they, so does this mean just go after the admin accounts and restrict single sign-on, or single sign-on now we just come to a conclusion is a mistake?
I'm stumbling over myself because I have grappled over that is single sign-on mistake thing a lot recently.
Well, you know, the other side of this is going to the consumer space. Folks that have been using their Facebook credentials to log on to everything, and then for whatever reason, they lose those access to those credentials, and now everything is broken.
Yeah. I've heard through friends of mine that run, you know, there's large free mail systems.
Yeah.
That it's common that when a particular account gets compromised, that, you know, they'll do something like they'll send an email out to every one of their contacts saying, oh, by the way, I'm stuck in Amsterdam. My wallet's been stolen. Please send me money.
Right.
And then they'll go in the mail account, the bad people, and they'll delete all the contacts. So, and they'll change the password and delete all the old mail. So you get, let's say you do recover your account to one of these systems. Unless you remember every one of your friend's contacts, you can't even send them an email saying, by the way, my account was compromised.
Yeah. You can't clean up. Like it's a recognition. I remember how long we've been beating this drum of, I want single sign-on. Now I feel like the security version of me goes, yeah, single sign-on's a plague.
Yeah. Well, but then you go back to the reason we wanted it in the first place, where if, and I'm going to give two scenarios, the bad one and the good one.
Mm-hmm.
The bad one is whenever someone is trying to get their work done, back to this productivity thing,
yep,
and all of a sudden they're typing in a window and all of a sudden this thing pops in front of their face and says, by the way, I don't care what you were just typing in. I need you to type in your username and password again. And they go, oh, okay, so what system is this for? Anyway, it's a productivity block. So if that happens more than, you know, a couple times in a day, that it really can hurt the productivity of a person.
And they end up undermining the security anyway. That's when they start, you know, making post-it notes with credentials and all that sort of stuff. Like, it doesn't actually achieve the goal you wanted of some sense of security.
Yeah, that's true. So the other side of it, which is coming up, and we're starting to call this our trusted device strategy, is most applications allow you to put in, like your browsers do, and client mail clients on a lot of consumer products, like the Apple products or the Samsung ones, allow you to type in the username and password, and it'll store it for you. So originally, if you jump back a couple years, I would go, oh, that's horrible. What happens if someone steals that device?
Right.
So we've put together this trusted device strategy so that whenever we have a couple control points, one of them is when that device either VPNs in or it uses, you know, Microsoft ActiveSync to connect to Exchange servers, we have these controls that say you don't get the mail or you don't get the VPN until we check certain number of posture things on the device, such
right.
as, is there a screen lock, requires a PIN, and do we have the ability to remotely wipe it? Because once those things are in place, storing those credentials on that individual device makes single sign-on, and I'm doing it in quotes, happen for the user.
Right.
But we have that control that, sure, you could steal the device, but you don't get those controls. So, but then again, you caveat that back to the Microsoft world, where everything just, you know, from Exchange to, you know, Windows clients, they just rely on it.
Well, and I like that we're starting to do more multi-factor authentication and actually do two steps. Actually, the thing I've liked the most as a guy who travels a lot is the Googles and Facebooks of the world, that as soon as you change something odd, you're in a different location, like, and if any one of the elements of the chain of that machine with that Mac on this kind of connection from this location, if it all's normal, then yeah, go ahead, use this, the built-in credentials. But as soon as anything changes, just throw a little request in. Hey,
yeah.
Can you tell me something about yourself?
Yeah, and we're going down that path as well. And I pointed out that Google does and some of those guys do a pretty good job of it.
Mm-hmm.
Some banks do too. And we're adding the same kinds of things. And that's, I like to call that the multiple things you know.
Yeah.
So it's not a true multi-factor. It's like pretend multi-factor, but it's still better than just a password.
Yeah, I just presume that everything's fine. Yeah, and I like that sort of bi-directional factoring too, where when you first set up the account, I found this with one of the banks I'm working with, they actually ask a bunch of information so that they can show it back to me to confirm it
yeah.
every time you log in.
Yes, yeah. I use a bank that does that same thing.
Yeah, sort of spoofing resistance.
My bank actually sends me a picture that I need to validate. And so one of the things I like about things like pictures or captures or stuff, it's also like a pretend multi-factor because you have to be able to see it.
Now, why do you say pretend? What do you mean when you mean multi-factor?
Oh, something you know, something you have, and something you are.
Right.
Where those things I say pretend because it's multiple things I know.
Yeah.
But the eye visual thing is almost something you are. It's not quite. Well, don't quote me on that. But if I have to recognize a picture and type something based on that picture,
right.
it's showing that I have eyeballs and I'm not a computer.
Right.
So it's still a little bit better than just something else I know.
Well, it's in a way, you've sort of confirmed an R. That is something you are. You must have had eyeballs.
Yeah, but there's no check that it's actually my eyeballs.
Right. And that's...
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I was just writing up a proposal for biometrics.
Mm-hmm.
For when we would allow them, for this digression, because we have a number of devices that are coming out that have fingerprint readers,
right?
Like Samsung devices and some others, and we're going to get these requests. Can't I just use the fingerprint reader and never have to type the password again?
Right.
So we've been vetting out these different requirements for it, because I heard these horror stories, like when Mercedes came out with the fingerprint readers, that, you know, horrible things would happen to the owner of that finger. So one of my requirements is, you know, the finger has to be alive.
Attached to the original owner?
Yes. So there has to be something in the test to determine that. But also, I just like something in a biometric test like that you also do something you know. So you put your finger down on a pad, LEDs fire through it, and just evaluate the waveform of your bloodstream on the other side. That's my particular favorite these days.
Right.
Because if it's deceased, it fails. But also just tracing a simple pattern, because it's something you know, but it also gives the user the ability to trace a duress pattern. So in the Mercedes case I was talking about, if, you know, I'm being held against my will, I just do a slightly different pattern. Everything unlocks and it seems normal to the bad people who are hanging out with me.
Right.
But the police are notified and GPS tracking or whatever happens so that the authorities can come,
yeah.
you know, save me.
And I'm reminded of the XKCD security comic where it's, you know, His laptop's encrypted, drug him and hit him with this $5 wrench until he tells us the password. Like, well, you don't have to cut off the thumb. You can just bring the guy along with enough incentive to use it.
Yeah. Well, that was another thing. They, with the Mercedes use cases, there were cases where they just threw the person into the trunk and pulled him out whenever they needed him. So I, anyway, that was one of mine. Another big one, since we're on the subject, I got from a coworker, a very smart guy named Rich West. He said, you know, I don't, if I, and he, when he first said this to me, it kind of caught me off guard. But he said, if I ever had to give a biometric sample to my employer, I would quit. And I said, well, why do you say that? And he said, well, it means that how I have to trust that they're going to maintain something securely that I can't change.
Right.
If it was a password, when I leave the company, in my new company, I could have a different password.
Yes.
Well, I can't get a new fingerprint.
Yeah, the biometric data is permanent.
Yeah, so, and then, So we added in a, two requirements to that. His version of it is a biometric sample needs to be revocable. Mine is biometric samples need to decompose over time. Well, an example of that, facial recognition came up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a use case where I want to make the person, when they show up at work in the morning, show up to a new endpoint, say, like, say, we have a case where it's a TV in a hotel room, a TV with new smart capabilities, and they want to use that as an endpoint, or just your regular laptop idea. Show up in the morning and do a full authentication, you know, use your smart card, you have a pin or other gesture tied to it to get two factors to authenticate you fully. At that moment, it would be fairly easy with camera technology to take a black and white image of your face, including hair, glasses, and your clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So throughout the day, if you, you can walk away, can, since your smart card has a, near-field communications on it, you get more than 10 feet away and it locks your screen.
Right.
When you come back later and sit down, if the smart card is within that 10 feet and the black and white of your hair, how shaven you are, your glasses and your shirt match, that biometric would work to not require the full authentication.
Right.
And the decompose over time thing comes in, you know, after a week, I will, if I haven't shaved or I'm wearing a different shirt or I just get a haircut, those would all, the previous biometric samples would fail.
Yeah, no, I like that, that it's, you, and it's the whole thing here is this, I don't want single sign-on forever. I want single sign-on today.
Yeah, for this work day.
Yeah, for this session of whatever this may be. Don't bother me in the next 4 hours and I'll be happy.
Yeah, for that, generally, our guideline we've been using for our web single sign-on tokens is 8 to 48 hours for active sessions.
Right.
So, like you said, whatever that session is.
Yeah, whatever is a reasonable session. Again, as a guy who goes into a lot of different offices, their ability to give me temporary credentials. Because I'm a difficult scenario. Actually, I need a fair number of rights right now while we're doing some assessments, but I'm gone at the end of the week. So these should all die.
Yeah, right.
And I think that routine behavior, I think people would be willing to jump through some hoops at the beginning of each day while you're having your coffee in exchange for no hoops for the rest of the day, unless something weird happens.
Yeah. I have toyed around with something weird happens. Cause I, when I go into office in San Jose, I have a fairly normal pattern.
Mm-hmm.
I usually get in basic work days to about 10 to 6. And after I'm there for about an hour and a half, I go get a coffee and I'm gone, walk over there, walk back. I'm back in about, you know, 8 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
At lunchtime, I often, well, when I don't take my laptop to lunch, which I sometimes do because we have, you know, Wi-Fi in the cafeteria, I will go at a, usually at about 11:45 or I go at 1:30 to just avoid the crowds and I'll go pick up food and come back. So I just, when I'm thinking about what's weird, that if that was defined as my normal behavior, that would be completely different than if I showed up, you know, 3 hours earlier and then took a 3 hour lunch.
Yes. Yeah. And I like the idea of a machine just being sensitive to, yeah, you were gone at the wrong time. So I'm just going to ask you a couple extra questions.
Yeah.
And I think the funny thing is we're seeing evidence of this all over the place. Soon, if I use my credit card in two different countries in the same day, I get a call.
Yeah, yeah, I appreciate that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. I don't think I've ever been unhappy to have a credit card security call.
There's the opposite, though, that's happened to me recently. And the first example I was going to give is when I'm traveling and I'm in one of our offices, you know, in Europe. And the timing's all different and my time's all different. So I'm going to get bugged a lot.
Yep.
So how do you solve that? I don't know is the answer. But I was recently in Thailand, actually, for a first responders conference. And I went to take money out of my ATM and it wouldn't work. So I didn't get a call or anything, but I had to call them and they said, yeah, we did think it was weird that you were suddenly in Thailand.
Yeah, that's not adequate.
Transactions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they could have, it's hard for, so this is my thing when I said I've looked into things to look into weird behavior.
Yeah.
It's hard to get to a point where you don't have too many false positives.
Yeah.
Without, you know, really bugging people.
Yeah, and you want to create an incentive to behave well, to make it easy to get over that threshold. It's just a small thing that actually raises your confidence level.
Yeah.
I think that's the interesting, very interesting challenge about security is the kind of security that makes you feel better about answering it.
Yeah. And you just reminded me of one of my newest projects,
yeah,
which is we're doing a phishing campaign where a number of the ways, the two most common ways we've seen people try to breach Fortune 500 companies in the United States is either by, you know, jacking up either a legitimate website, you know, like say a newspaper or one of the newspaper's advertisers to, you know, do some sort of drive-by, or even more popular is the phishing emails.
Mm-hmm.
Phishing emails with a payload, or say you've already got something on their site and you look into Active Directory to see the list of, you know, domain admins or something else, you know, like HR or, you know, some other group name that looks attractive, and send the members of that, you know, spear phishing emails.
Sure.
So anyway, we've launched this phishing campaign, and one of the things we realized pretty quickly is we're teaching people to not click on legitimate emails.
Right.
In our case, legitimate emails are often originated from HR, but HR is outsourced different functions to third parties.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like whether it's, you know, it's our healthcare providers, 401k provider, you just, or others, you know, so those third parties are going to send emails that we're training people not to click on.
Right.
So one of the challenges now that I'm going through is coming up with a set of guidelines for those, for our HR folks, so that when they make a contract with, you know, one of those third-party healthcare providers, that they can send an email that lets people feel confident enough that they can actually click on the link.
Yeah, I think it is an art form to craft an email in a way that gives people confidence.
Yeah, so one of the things, that, you know, so I've been toying with this, and there's a number of standards in the area, like, say, DKIM or SPF to determine from the outside coming in, give you a better idea from the mail itself, whether you should tag it or something at your edge. But still, there's going to be stuff that gets through. So the lowest common denominator I've been able to come up with is if inside the links that you click on, instead of saying something like, you know, Party 3, Cisco's healthcare provider, and then have a link to Party 3's, and I made up that name, their URL in the email, if instead it said, you know, Cisco healthcare provider, and the link you click on is something at Cisco.com. So you click on that, it's Cisco.com, you can even authenticate it to Cisco.com, and then that site, which is internal, would redirect you out to the third party,
right,
with a SAML assertion to give you single sign-on out to that third party.
And it's just basically, you trust me, so you could trust me to do these redirects.
Yeah. Because we had a legitimate one came out that we were all looking at, because this is our new hobby. My friend Doug and I, we look at new emails that have come in, and we try to figure out, you know, if they're fake or not, and or what they could have done to seem less fake if they were real.
Right.
And there was one that he found where it came into the link you click on, went out to the third-party provider, who then did a redirect back to sso.cisco.com.
Mm-hmm.
So that was valid. And then get a SAML assertion to redirect back out to the provider. But so that was all legitimate, but it just from a user perspective, just seems a little weird.
Yeah, it smelled bad.
Yeah.
We've just never fixed email. All of the different certification processes and so forth, I don't think we give people confidence just because we show a lock on an email.
Yeah, I've said this a few times with different technologies come out, with Federation technologies to do, dynamic Federation agreements. And one of the first proposals that came out for that, before it went to the IETF for the SAML V2 spec, and the proposal came back, why don't we have a whitelist and blacklist of companies that we would possibly want to federate with? And back to email, I said, well, we tried that with email, and we failed. We failed SMTP 20 years ago, and we're still cleaning up the mess.
Sure, because you could spoof it into the whitelist easily enough.
Yeah, so this federation stuff, we need to get something better from the start.
Yeah.
So that we don't run into that same mess.
Just not allow those same mistakes going on.
What I proposed was, if we're doing, service provider-initiated federation agreements, really it has to tie back to something valid. And to me, it's a PKI infrastructure.
Yeah.
If I'm your service provider, you come to Cisco.com for the first time, and you type in your email address into a page, and I can go back and look up your public key, and we have, it's in the same chain as what we have installed in all the browsers, the PKCS11 cert chains. I can get a validation that the public key that you generated and subsequently the SAML assertions you sign,
right.
I can validate that we have common trust between us.
Right. Yeah, and I'm still dealing with the average IT guy struggles mightily to deal with certificates.
Yeah. So the trend I'm seeing or kind of plugging for that is to have public identity providers so yep. that you could contract out your federation to the cloud to an identity provider you trust, whether that company be Ping Identity or VMware or Salesforce's identity initiative. Mm-hmm. And there's some others. I'm sorry, I've left a couple out. Because I'm not allowed to endorse any of them.
That's fair. Totally fair. But now we're back to that sort of single sign-on problem. Should someone, and I have no vested interest in Ping Identity at all, I think nothing but good thoughts about those guys, but if they ever got compromised, how screwed are we?
Well, that's back to one of those cloud initiative things. Since you said Ping, I'll say Okta.
Okay.
just so that we're being fair and judicious.
Yeah, being fair.
Well, when the cloud first came, the whole idea of the cloud and outsourcing things to the cloud, and I said outsource on purpose, the whole thing came up with a lot of people were just really concerned about the security of it.
Yep.
Oh my God, it's not going to be secure.
Yeah.
But in reality, if you take, let's say there's only 100 people in the entire world that do really good at security.
Yep.
For securing, a data center and, software in that data center that's yep. running as a service or a platform. And you get them to think it out and they get it right the first time, or they vet it amongst the community to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably going to be a pretty secure solution compared to every individual company's IT staff that in a lot of cases are just not staffed to do, they're not staffed with one of those 100 security professionals.
No, nor should they be. But this is the essence of the cloud all along. You know, this great game of it's not reliable enough. It's just, have you looked at the reliability stats on our own data centers? Come on.
Yeah, yeah.
These guys are better equipped. There's more of them. They're all 24/7. It's hard to argue those things.
Well, it's also a specialization thing. We started outsourcing things back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that we thought someone else could do better.
Yep.
Like we used to have our own travel agency that could print out plane tickets, make hotel for you. But we realized there's other companies that specialize that. They even specialize in that in different parts of the world.
Sure.
So then we just went down the line to just move everything that we weren't core competency, like I mentioned HR earlier, into these spaces.
Yeah.
So we're giving it to the experts
yeah.
to do so that we can concentrate on being the experts in our space.
Well, then there's the core battle of hypocrisy. I mean, it's for me too, as a consultant, it's like, hey, I'm an expert in a few things and I only use experts for all the other things. How could you not?
Yeah.
It's absolutely fair. So, David, any final call-outs for us terrified folks out here saying, how are we going to manage these identity breaches? Like, what do you look at first?
Well, the thing that I'm evangelizing this year is the runbook of the teams that the Mandiant report called out, and then the Verizon data breach investigation report verified, is the targeting of the Windows operating system.
Right.
Its single sign-on mechanism and older versions of it, which were more susceptible to malware.
Yes.
So that those could be, you know, like I said, the remote access vector for miscreants into your enterprise.
Yeah.
So the reason I was down at the First Responders Conference is we spent the last year coming up with Windows operating system specific mitigations for those compromises, and we're willing to share.
Great. Where can we go?
PDF format of those documents. I don't have a handy URL. What I've been doing so far is, as people ask me for it over email, I send it to them.
Okay.
But maybe we could figure out something smarter than that. But
we'll figure out some place we could put it. Yeah, so the folks can get it if they want it.
Okay.
I totally appreciate that. You know, and I'm a big believer in update and patch. Most of the time these problems are solved, we're just not taking good enough care of the machines.
And in this particular case, the initial exploits are mostly the older versions of the operating system, like Windows XP that's not even supported by Microsoft anymore.
Right. Yeah. Well, it is.
And I still see it everywhere.
But it is what? 12 years old? It's 12 years.
Yeah. And I complain about that a lot at work, but then my children's school, or even the facilities that at the hotel, the first conference was at, they have Windows XP machines. I got to walk up to the platform and say, and by the way, and as I'm talking about this, I'm willing to bet, because I've been asked this before, hey, Mr. Security Guy, tell me something I don't know. I'll say, well, do you have any Windows XP computers inside your company? Yes, I do. And then I'll say, well, I'll bet you $20 that you have botnets running inside your company, and I don't even have to go look.
Right. Because it's just the norm when it comes to those XP machines.
Yeah, well, and I just want to make sure people don't think I'm bashing Microsoft. Because when Microsoft came out with Windows XP and the version of Office back then, that wasn't their goal. Was not a secure operating system. Their goal was to have the same kernel that's running on servers, running on clients, but have it perform well so that users would have a good user experience.
Right.
So that was their focus. And they've since come back with subsequent releases of the operating systems that, as we said earlier, Windows 7 or Windows 8, just you can't compromise in the same way that you can compromise Windows XP.
Now, the whole Ring 3, Ring 0 thing, which was a fine idea in 2001, is just dealt with differently today.
Yeah, there was with a focus on the securing thing, or with a lot of, you hear it a lot these days with, containerized applications.
Yep.
You know, it's a concept we didn't really have 10 years ago.
No, it just didn't work that way.
We had it 25 years ago on running on IBM VMs.
But yes. what's old is new, my friend. What can I tell you?
Yeah.
Let's come back around again. Hey, Dave, it's really fun to talk to you. I appreciate your insights.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
You bet. And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.